to Vegas Ringside Rundown. Your go-to podcast for all things youth hockey, starting here in Las Vegas and going beyond the rink to cities across the country. We're all about highlighting the rising stars, coaches, and organizations that are shaping the future of the game. Hosted by Jim and Ron. Each episode brings you in-depth interviews with players, coaches, and key figures in the youth hockey world. Whether we're covering the latest action in Vegas or hitting the road to bring you stories from rinks nationwide, you'll get an insider's look at the talent and passion driving youth hockey today. Let's lace up and hit the ice. This is Vegas Ringside Rundown.
This is the Coaches Masterclass Series for Vegas Ringside Rundown. And I'm here with Harrison Luce, head coach for the 15U AAA team, Vegas Junior Golden Knights. His background includes a rich playing history and coaching experience. He played for the Salisbury School varsity team, where they won the New England Championship in 2014. He has also competed with the Hamilton Red Wings in the Ontario Junior Hockey League, OJHL, from 2012 to 2013. Harrison was selected in both the 2011 Ontario Hockey League OHL draft by the Sault Ste. Marie Greyhounds, and in 2012 United States Hockey League USHL drafted by the Muskegon Lumberjacks. Harrison's coaching career spans various roles, including being a TPH Academy coach and a progressive hockey development coach in Linden, Ontario, between 2013 and 2018. Additionally, he has worked with the Vegas Junior Golden Knights younger teams, 10U, and served as a youth hockey manager for the Vegas Golden Knights organization. Harrison, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Can you tell me a little bit about your
dad, your grandfather? Can you just tell me a little bit about them again?
Yep. So my grandfather, Don, was drafted by the New York Rangers and from the Kitchener Rangers, and then he went on to play for the Rangers and then predominantly for the Buffalo Sabres from 70 to 80. Played for a couple other teams, the Red Wings, Leafs, and the Kings, and then ended up working for the Sabres, the Flyers, and the Leafs in hockey operations up until 2016, I think.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. And then my father played, he was a goalie, he played in every league, in the WHL, the OHL, a little bit at college, and then ended up playing in the American League for a little bit and some other minor pro before he went on to work as a scout and work in scouting in the NHL. Okay. For a couple different teams.
And your brother, you have a brother in hockey too, right?
Yes, Griffin. He played with me at Salisbury and then was selected to play for the National Development Team for 2 years, played for them, went on to play 4 years at Michigan, and then started his pro career between the AHL and the...
So how many years total have you been playing hockey?
So if I ended in 2014, I would have played from 2000 to 2014, so 14 years.
14 years?
Yeah.
Wow, it's a long time. Name off some of those other sports you played while you were playing youth hockey.
Yeah, youth hockey I would have played baseball... baseball, volleyball, basketball, track and field. I actually played badminton in high school a little bit.
Okay.
And then not concurrently with hockey, but then I ended up rowing in college afterwards. So that was like my main second sport after hockey.
Did you win anything with the rowing? Oh,
yeah. I mean, we were a Division I college rowing team.
Okay.
Small school, Hobart's a small school. So rowing actually is not an NCAA sport. It's governed by a different kind of third party. It's called the IRA.
Okay.
And we would compete, you know, like Hobart's a small school, 1,500 to 2,300 kids, and we would compete against Division I schools all the time.
So when you were in school, right, how far did you go as far as school goes? Did you finish college? Do you have a degree?
Where I have my master's degree.
Okay.
I have a master's degree in Intelligence International Affairs from the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University in Ottawa.
Okay.
And then I have my bachelor's. I do a double major in French and Francophone Studies and International Relations from Hobart, William Smith College.
Okay.
You know, I speak a couple different languages. I've lived all over the world, and I have a pretty good global experience. And then my wife, she's Persian, so I have learned a little bit of Farsi, but not much.
Well, see, kids, you can learn a lot, and you can go to school and get a master's and a bachelor's and still play hockey and coach hockey. So you heard it first from Harrison Luce. Make sure you go to school, get good grades. That's important because it just opens up more doors. So you've played on a really, really good team.
Yep.
What was the name of that team again?
Salisbury Crimson Knights, 13-14.
Wow. And, yeah. But prior to that, you were on a... I wouldn't say it was a bad team. You just couldn't win.
Oh, we were terrible. I can say it.
Yeah, okay. We were bad. Absolutely terrible. So having a winning team and a losing team, knowing that you're winning more, obviously that's a good thing, but how do you prep yourself for that?
Yeah, it's different mentality. I would say, you know, I knew relatively, I was always a very physical player. I was always finishing my hits. I had definitely had a role to play that's more of a traditional grinder, fourth line role.
Yeah.
But I knew that whatever time that I spent on the ice, I had to maximize my effectiveness, right? I had to take whatever impact I could have on the game and get it done in whatever limited amount of time that I had.
For the kids that are listening out there that maybe are currently on a losing streak from 8U up to could be USPHL, what are some of the tips or tricks that you could do as a player to actually kind of fight through some of those struggles of having those losses?
I will first plug the coaches. So I'm sure, you know, if there's a competent coach, there's a message that's being sent to that team of trying to get the team to buy into some kind of team identity and team system.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's sometimes some resistance or some, it takes a little bit of time before everyone's kind of bought into that team message and team identity. Sometimes the only way out is through, right? It's buying into that team system, creating that team identity. That would be my first step. And then on an individual level is just reducing your expectations, right? You can't show up to the rink and be like, I'm going to will my team to win this game.
Yeah.
I'm going to put the cape on and do this. It's like, I'm going to control what I can control every single shift, right? It's like, do that self-assessment. Every time you get off the ice, you think like, what's one positive thing that I did that shift? And it doesn't, like, you're not going to score a goal every shift.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to have an assist. You're not going to have a point, right? But did I get a hit in? Did I be on the right side of the puck? Did I move the puck efficiently? Like, you know, reduce and kind of make your metrics a little bit smaller and more tangible on a shift-to-shift basis, and you can create that confidence in your game to, you know, grow as an individual.
Okay. And then what would be the takeaway from a winning team? What would you still have to continue to grow or do to drive to be better, even though you're winning, right?
Yeah.
You know, some kids mentally are like, well, we're winning. You know, I'm good.
Yeah, there's that. It's a different trap of the complacency trap of like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But
yeah,
you still have to have that urgency to compare yourself. I always tell our teams, like, we don't ever compare yourself down, right? You have to find some kind of external motivation and comparison so that you can practice above the level of your competition, right?
Mm-hmm.
On an individual basis, you always need to think like, whatever I'm doing and whatever I'm working on, there's someone else somewhere else working harder than me and doing more. Right?
Yeah.
So you have to have that mentality of more.
Being on those types of teams, I know it's got to be tough, but how does that prepare you for coaching?
Yeah, I think you can draw on a lot of different experiences. Thinking back to when you were a player, I think that's the easiest part of coaching, is you just have a wealth of knowledge to draw on when you were a player, a captain, a leader on a team, thinking back to your other coaches, how they handle different scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
If you can reflect on all the information that you have with your experiences, it's a lot easier. But I had a big spectrum of wins and losses, so a lot to draw on.
Your first opportunity to coach, you said, was with the 10U.
Yeah.
In 2021.
Yep, to 2022.
And we were talking about the highs and lows. Can you just reiterate the highs and lows of that team? Try to give some perspective for the players listening.
Yeah, that team, when you're in 10U and there's a lot of kids playing 10U for the first time, you've got some of them that have never played full ice hockey before, right? Some of them that have literally had the equipment for 2 years. They're just new players, right? There's a huge learning curve at that age. You can see some players who their shot will increase 500% throughout the season. It's like the only time in your life where you're going to see a 500% improvement in your shot's power. But kind of teaching the game to the kids and then teaching how to win within the game, that's one hurdle. But it's a great age to just see a great, percentage of improvement.
I'm sure you've seen, extreme improvement. Now you've kind of jumped up to the 15 team. You're obviously seeing more improvement, obviously stronger kids, taller kids.
Yeah.
Is there any takeaway just from that age level that you, as a head coach, that you're, you could work on or be better at? And is there anything that you can draw from your previous experiences going through yourself as far as how you would draw on it? Like, do you reflect back on, different coaches that drive you who you are today?
Yes. Yeah, for sure. I've been lucky to have a couple. I think it's great to have a diverse experience. I've had a couple great coaches and I've had some not so good coaches.
Yeah.
And I think as long as you look at every experience and be able to take something away, if you take something away, say, I never want to be like that, or I want to be like that, it's still a valuable lesson. But, specifically to the 15U age, it's an age where physical maturity, there's still a huge range of kids, as they're developing as adolescents. And then emotionally, there's some developments as well. They have different stresses now that they're in high school, now that they have a different life at home.
Yeah.
There's a different urgency too with their development. So it's a huge transitional age, but I would say the one thing too is you can talk to a 10U team after a loss and they're going to go back to the hotel and play mini sticks and they're not going to remember anything that you said. With the 15Us, you hope that they do remember what you said and then they reflect on it. I actually kind of encourage taking it home with them a little bit more, right? Like having a little bit more of an accountability, a passion, and like wearing how they feel a little bit more so that it can affect and you can add that as motivation to improve or do whatever you need to do.
As coach-parent relationship goes, you're coaching the kids. The parents come in after the kids leave you, right? They're driving home. What's one of the things that you can reflect back on with your dad that really worked well for you after, say, a tough loss?
I would say usually it depends on your kid. Parents will know best. Usually you'll know if your child is aware of what they could have done better or if they're completely oblivious to it. You can have both scenarios, right? If they don't understand and they're just kind of like, wow, we lost that game, that's too bad, but I don't feel anything.
Yeah.
It's different than you can just see it on their face, when they walk out, if they're disappointed in themselves, disappointed in the team, disappointed in the result, right? Mm-hmm. It's different kid to kid, but for the most part, I would assume that if you believe that you have a competent coach for your kid, like they should be aware of how they should feel, right? Mm-hmm. Either just taking the lead from how the coach expressed it or the lead from their peers or just how they feel personally. But usually they'll know what mistakes they made, how the team could have been better, and how the result should have been different. Usually they'll know all those things. So it's more important to just invite. I always would value some things that my parents would say to me. And it was always like, what am I going to do to affect a change? Right. Yeah. It's like, okay, you're mad about that. What are you going to do about it? Like, are you going to work harder now? Are you going to work less now, right? Like, what do you, what, give them the personal empowerment to be like, you can affect your situation. What are you going to do about it one way or the other? I think if they get those repetitions of thinking that way, then they control their own destiny and they think like, my hard work can benefit myself and the team down the line.
Mm-hmm. For your dad, like after a good win or a loss, is he having that conversation with you in the car driving home?
Yeah, it would mostly be following my lead. Like if I had a bad game, I would never just be on eggshells walking out and thought I was going to get ripped in the car. It was more like I could open the door by asking a question, and you know, I know that my father works in the NHL, so I'm going to get a coherent answer. But you know, it was always at my invitation that I could get that advice rather than just get expecting to get laid into regardless.
Yeah. You know? Let me ask you this. Have you ever been laid into?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Like every single kid around the entire world, I definitely have made some mistakes.
Okay, right?
Made some mistakes on the ice as a player, doing things, bad penalties, suspensions, stuff like that. And
sure.
I own it. You know, like it teaches you the accountability of like what's right, what's wrong. And sometimes, yeah, you need direct negative reinforcement as a coach, as a parent, to so that you can ensure that your kid or the player that you have knows the difference between what's right and what's wrong, what's acceptable, what's not. And as long as you can express that in a way of like, you know, it's not a personal thing, but this, what you did was wrong, you can't do it again, I think that they can have that respect and learn that lesson.
So there you go, parents. Be mindful of when you're having those conversations, those crucial conversations with your kid post game. Sometimes you just want to wait for your own kid to open up and say, hey dad or hey mom, how'd you think I played?
Right.
And that would give you an opportunity because they're looking for feedback, obviously.
Yeah.
Is that most parents aren't as fortunate as you to have a dad that or a grandfather that played in the NHL. Not that they were by your side driving home, but that's definitely somebody that you can definitely go to and have a conversation with. Most of the kids are going to the parents to say, what do you think? What'd you see? And some of these parents obviously really didn't step into the hockey world until recently. The Flurry effect, we have so many goalies. Like most places and organizations don't have as many goaltenders as we did because of Flurry and the kids really wanting to emulate it. Now, I'm thankful my kid not become a goalie because that's expensive too. It's all expensive. But I've talked with goalie parents, and that process, that path is very expensive.
Yeah.
But there is an opportunity for kids to play and have fun. Can you give me some of the breakdown of your previous coaching experiences that you took from that you're now applying in your current situation?
Yeah, I would say, I've been lucky to have some great coaches and some not so good coaches, and you can learn things from both of them. Specifically as it comes to hockey, one of my favorite coaches and coaching staffs was when I was at Salisbury.
Yeah.
Our head coach Andrew Will, Brian Finney, and John Toffey. It was a great group of men that we were always prepared for everything. Right? We knew exactly what we were doing when we came to practice. It was all posted for us. We were prepared for each game. We were prepared for each power play scenario, each penalty kill scenario. We had all the information from a coaching staff. It was just our job to go out and execute.
Yeah.
That was awesome. I think also as I said earlier, the individual feedback part is some guys only respond when you're yelling in their face. Mm-hmm. Some guys will never respond if you're yelling in their face.
Yeah.
That's just an easy example, but there's an individual feedback mechanism that's important. I think those coaches really understood that. I remember one time, you know, I told you I was a fourth line, more of a role player, and my coach was trying to get me more involved, get me more opportunities, and he wanted to try me as like a net front guy on the power play. Mm-hmm. And like we were going through practice and like I wasn't very good. Like I just wasn't very good.
Okay.
And I was not making the power play better.
Okay.
And so I said to him, I was like, I appreciate you giving me this opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I understand if it's not the best thing for the team. Like, okay. I want our team to score power play goals.
Yeah.
I think it was at a time in the year where maybe it was we had a couple easier games coming up. So I appreciated it from a coaching perspective, but I also was like, I'm not going to take away from our team's success for my own individual. Maybe that was the wrong decision at the time, but I knew that we weren't better because of me, right? And there were other competent players that were good at that position.
What did coach say to you on that?
I think he was like, he appreciated my honesty, but most likely I think he was probably going to make that decision regardless, but it probably was helpful as a coach. Now that I'm a coach, it was probably helpful to be like, oh, whew, all right, he's not going to be mad at me.
He was testing to find out if you were going to be upset or
exactly,
not playing.
Yeah.
And you took the pressure off of him. You basically said,
I was more of a PK guy anyways. I like playing on the penalty kill. And I was decent at that. So I was like, I'd rather just do that.
Okay. Yeah. You can still score on a PK, right?
Or I take pride in limiting the other team's chances too. Like, I really, good penalty killers take pride in really, it's a time in the game where you can get huge momentum shifts. Your team can rally behind you. You can block a shot. You can do a lot of things on the penalty kill that help your team. So
yeah, no, that's huge. And that's great to know. And it's nice to know that, you know, as a coach, you know, I always think of coaches, I don't really, that's why we want to have this on the podcast, as far as just talking like their history and past, because some of these coaches you don't know.
Right.
Like, okay, you could name some teams that, I played for this and that, but really, what did you do?
Yeah.
Where did you draw your inspiration? Is there a head coach that you look up to, that you inspire to?
Like an NHL head coach?
It could be anybody, really.
College. I just like to learn different things from all of the coaches. I wouldn't say that I'd be able to pin it on one. A lot of the NHL teams, they do training camp videos.
Yeah.
Where they talk to the teams and you get like to see the coach's first meeting with all the team. And they set the standard for the year and they say, we're going to be this kind of team. We're going to work on these things. We're going to take pride in these things in our game. And seeing how they prepare professionals.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really interesting, and there's a lot of diverse coaching styles as it comes to that. So I try to take as much as I can from wherever. Being at City National Arena every day during the season, there's so much that you can learn from just watching practices all the time. So I take drills from that. I take watching how the coaches interact with the players, you know, seeing how the professional life starts with, you get to the rink, you do a video meeting, you warm your body up, you go on the ice, then you know, you're done for the day. There's so much that I learn from, I take the information from where I can get it.
So probably not so much look up to, because it's hard, you don't really emulate a specific coach, but probably, as you were saying, when you're looking at those drills and stuff of what they're doing, what they're putting out on the ice, the product they're putting out there, you want to pull from, say, hey, you know, I can implement that with my team, right?
Yep.
I would think, and I'm sure you would agree, and you can tell me if you don't, that's totally fine. Most of your coaching really is coming back to past experiences from previous coaches.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Out of the coaches you did work under as a youth hockey player and a, is it professional? I guess I get a little confused with the OH?
OHL is the
Ontario Hockey League, right?
And then the OJHL is a tier down from that.
Okay.
So it's not like OHL is part of the CHL, which is a major junior league.
Okay.
Where it's different than the OJHL. That's just a tier two junior league. Yeah.
So in those different leagues, or what you've played so far, have you seen any coaching differences that you been able to like identify?
Yes.
Okay.
I think like I've had coaches where if they're always yelling, there comes a point where you stop listening.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Like if you're always being yelled at, if it's just a screaming match all the time, it's easy to tune those guys out.
Yeah.
I've also had coaches where you are waiting for them to show some emotion.
Yeah.
Right? Where you need to think like, I'm passionate about playing right now. Is the coach as passionate about being here as me?
Mm-hmm.
Had those opportunities. So there's always something you can learn from that. I think on the positive side, though, as it comes to coaches, is every player wants to feel respected. right? Every player wants to feel the respect from their coach, but it's a fine line as a coach where you need to be able to respect them as an individual, but you need to toe that line professionally where it's like, if you make a mistake, I'm going to tell you directly that you made a mistake and that you need to be better, but it doesn't mean that I hate you as a person,
yeah.
right? It's like, my job is to make you better.
Yeah.
Let's buy into that feedback mechanism where I can confront you directly, but it's not a reflection of how I feel as you as a hockey player or as an individual.
Okay. No, that's awesome. So some of the parents, so some of the things throughout the years, parents see like a coach that's not super animated on the bench, right?
Yeah.
Coach that's not yelling at the kids or just kind of there. Are they really coaching or not? Right. That some of the parents really will look back and go, I don't know if they're really talking to our kids.
Yeah.
Clear the air there. Harrison,
yeah, that's a great,
you know,
great question. I've had that question asked to me. And I'll circle back to what I was saying as it comes to, like, if you get someone that's yelling all the time,
yeah,
inevitably, when they're not yelling, is the only time you listen. So there has to be a balance, an emotional balance. It's just about emotional stability. You're not too high, you're not too low. And, you know, you do need to show some emotion and you do need to directly confront and hold people accountable and, you know, however that message can be delivered. But for the most part, what I've said to parents before is, like, if you see me on the bench and I'm in a calm demeanor,
yeah,
that's because I want my team to be calm, right? So if there's bad calls being made by the refs or there's dirty plays being made by the other team and I'm not screaming and yelling, when you're watching as a parent in the stands, it's actually counterproductive if you're the one screaming and yelling, especially with younger kids.
Yeah.
Like, I've had kids on the bench sometimes where they're like, they're watching everything their parents are doing in the stands.
Yeah.
And it's taking them away. It's not helping the coach to do their job. It's taking away from your kid's development.
Yeah.
And, like, your kid probably leaves the rink thinking, like, man, I wish my parent didn't act that way. Right? That's a tough thing to see sometimes as a,
yeah.
as a coach. But I think it's different coaching style. You can't speak for every coach.
Sure.
I think, like, definitely sometimes I raise my voice sometimes and I hold the kids accountable and I let them know. But if you're doing it all the time, it just, you lose the room quick as a coach.
Yeah.
And that's what I find. Like, you have to have a fine line and a balance. And
okay.
you have to also start the year with establishing, I say to the kids all the time, like, when you come to the rink, I'll ask you how your day went, how your family is, how school went, what's going on in your life. I care about who you are as a person, and I care about your family, and I care about that stuff. The second that we step on the ice, that stuff is moved to the side, and now it's about how are we going to become a better hockey player,
yeah.
and how are we going to become a better team.
Yeah.
So
that doesn't mean that he's not coaching.
Right.
Right? Just because you see a very animated coach out there, doesn't mean that he may not even have control of the team, depending on how loud. You
yeah.
might like it as a parent going, okay, I could see him coaching.
Yeah.
But it really just depends on the demeanor of the coach and what situations they're in. Obviously, if you're up by like 10-0, you know, you're probably going to see a chill coach.
Yeah.
But let's say that it's a tight game or a close game. You might see a little bit more animation, but animation does not equate to good or bad coaching. It just equates to what you see. So don't pay much mind to that.
Yeah. Like an example. After the first period of the game, your team is down 3-0, and you expect the coach to be going up and down the bench, yelling at the players, getting them fired up to go. But the three goals that were scored came from a missed offsides. One went off your player's skates, and then the other one was like a player lost an edge and fell and turned the puck over, and it's a breakaway the other way.
Yeah.
Three unfortunate goals happen in a game.
Mm-hmm.
As a coach, I'm not going to be going and yelling at the team, right? I would rather be like, guys, we had a couple tough breaks there.
Yeah.
We still have a chance to, you know, it starts with one goal. We got to get one goal back, and then we can go from there, right?
Yeah.
But if you need to look at, there's so many circumstances in the game that'll dictate how you would respond as a coach. So there's always some subjectivity to, like, the response that you might see.
Yeah. See you out on the ice with the stripes on.
Yeah.
Does that give you advantage?
Absolutely gives you advantage point. I understand, obviously, all the rules of the game.
Yeah.
But the other thing, too, is, like, I would say to my wife when I was reffing very consistently, like, it wouldn't be a normal week if I didn't come home and someone told me that I'm terrible at my job and they hate me and that I'm incompetent and a loser. You know, like, it's just sometimes what you expect as a ref.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a thankless job, but the game can't happen without the referees.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, specifically to the Las Vegas community, refs know more about the game than the parents in the stands.
Absolutely.
So you can have refs that are good, that are bad, that are indifferent, but again, it's a thankless job, and any time that there is bad reffing and I'm coaching, that's when you'll see me get more animated, because I do take the ref's perspective, right? If I think, like, for example, we've had some suspensions this year. Some of them, from a USA Hockey objective rules standpoint, are just suspensions.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like I don't care about the kid on my team and I won't advocate for him, but objectively, that's a penalty, that's a suspendable offense. It just happens sometimes.
Yeah.
And then there are other times where, as a ref, if you don't communicate or you enforce the rules incorrectly, that's when I would be a little bit more, you know, animated or confrontational with the referees.
Yeah.
But no matter what, for the most part, they don't show up wanting to do a bad job.
Yeah.
Right? They don't show up wanting to do a bad job. And I always, like, say to parents, could you imagine if there's 100 people next to your cubicle and every keystroke that you do on your computer is being, you know, analyzed, and, like, these people work jobs, they have families, they just want to make a little extra money, right? So sometimes they're allowed to make no mistakes, zero mistakes, and everyone makes mistakes in their job, right? So so long as the refs communicate, they can own their mistakes, they can be human, then I have no issue with it, right?
Okay, so I'll give you an example. It just happened yesterday.
Yeah.
How do you get a tripping call when a kid does not trip, actually literally fall on the ground? Is that a real penalty? Or because he almost fell, or he was in the act of almost tripping, you can call that as a tripping?
Was that the Thomas penalty?
I think so. It was, man, I know you talked to the ref. I know you had a conversation. I saw you at least trying to talk to the ref about it. It was more at the end. I think it was more at the end. Stuff like that. Does that frustrate you? Or do you, because of being a ref?
It depends on the context of the game. Like, if we're up 4-2 and we've got the momentum on our side. And it just depends on what our team needs at that time. Like, if I don't think the other team is a threat on the power play, and I think that we can kill the penalty pretty efficiently and it's not going to affect us, I'll probably just eat it.
Is it truly, so you're ref, you tell me, do they have to be in the act of falling, or do they have to fall? They actually have to trip to be called tripping, though. I guess that's the question I was having. It didn't make sense to me.
You can call a tripping penalty as long as, like, they're forward progress is impeded, or, like, their space is taken away, it still counts as...
Even though he got a shot off and he got by the player, because that's what happened. That's what didn't make sense to me.
Maybe it's not a great call, but there's enough wiggle room in the rule book that you can still call it. Yeah.
No, appreciate that.
Because there's, you know, like, you could... An efficient ref would argue, like, well, your player needs to control his stick better. The attacking player had a direct lane to the net, and your player illegally impeded on his progress. Like, there's a textbook definition there that could, you know, get you out of a confrontation.
How about the fine line of one kid being ejected for a hit to the head, and then you see that again in the corner? How do you not make that same call as a ref? What's your thoughts on that?
It depends on how you view the game as a referee. Some referees will come to the rink and saying, I'm going to control everything this game.
Yeah.
And some people are going to come to the game and say, whatever's there will be called. Right?
Okay.
Objectively, my job is to enforce the rules. I'm not going to have an impact on the game. So it depends on an individual basis as it comes to referees. Specifically in our game, as I said to our team. There was a huge hit in their end earlier, the shift before, right? Mm-hmm. One of our players was a huge hit in their end that was no penalty. But as you watch, their coach is then talking to the referee for mm-hmm. 30 to 45 seconds, mm-hmm. right? So as a player, you should expect that the next time that one of our team delivers a big hit, that it's going to be looked at very carefully by the ref.
Okay.
Right? So maybe the ref is feeling, oh, maybe I missed that one before, but the next big one I'm going to be more aware of.
Yeah.
Right? So that circumstance works against you. And then the other thing, too, with the other penalty is, like, ref positioning, too. Like, I don't know if this is something that, you know, this is specific to our game yesterday.
Sure. But
there was a younger ref and an older ref. The younger ref called zero penalties. The older ref called every single penalty mm-hmm. in that game. And he was at the far corner
yep.
when he called the penalty against Jake on our team.
Yes.
Right? So yes. it's, you know, you can't expect him to be able to decide from there the difference between a 2 and a 10 and a major. Because yeah. It's not his call to make, right? He's not doing us a favor, but he's doing his job to the best of his ability from that vantage point.
Yeah.
But it's the other guy's job to make that call.
Got
right?
it.
So
maybe he's
hugely subjective.
Yeah, and maybe he's protecting that type of hit, meaning he saw it, he needs to say something. Like if
right.
he, as you said, the younger ref probably was hesitant to make that call, but he knew from, because I was pretty much at the same vantage point as that ref, the guy that yeah. actually made the call, because I was at the one end looking down the ice, and I was like, ooh, that's a pretty big hit.
Yeah.
And they had put the 5 minutes up, and then they had taken it off mm-hmm. to change it to a 2 minute. So maybe that's where the younger ref came in and said, no, this is what I saw.
Yeah, right.
Sorry, I didn't make that call. Thanks yeah. for making it. But it wasn't as egregious as the previous play right. or whatever. We obviously get there an hour ahead of time.
Yeah.
Sometimes those same refs are the same refs that are going to be playing in your game. Do you pay any mind to that, to the ref situation at all?
Like who the refs are for each
like
game?
Like for example, like if you're watching the game prior and you're seeing the refs making the calls, do you pay, does that come into
play? Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one specific example was, when I got kicked out in Fargo.
Yeah.
When I got ejected from the game, the ref the game before had ejected the coaches, right? So I mean, you already know that that's a standard, and just watching the urgency or the competency or the professionalism of their calls, you can tell like what you're going to be in for.
Yeah,
right. So
yeah.
I always watch and I always prepare the team too. You can even get information from like what they say to you when they shake your hands before.
Really?
Like it's like, okay, it's going to be this guy's show today, or yeah, I'm like, think we got a good crew. Like you could usually tell from even just a brief interaction.
Wow. Okay. Is that tough, getting ejected from the game?
Depends. I mean, honestly, this is like this is probably more of a personal thing as a coach. Other coaches, I think there's a time and place too.
Yeah.
Depends on like what your team needs. Sometimes, like I was telling you, your team wants to see your emotion. They
yeah.
want to see you stick up and advocate for one of their teammates. If they think that one of their teammates is, you know, done wrong by and like, you know, suspended unjustly, mm-hmm. they want to see them be defended, right? So sometimes you have that reflection time where if it's like, maybe I got to do this right now to get some more out of my team.
Yeah, get some fire.
When I was in Fargo, I mean, that was not my goal at all. I think it was just I told him it was an offside call and I used a swear word and then I was ejected and that was it. But there was no, I didn't scream and yell or fight or anything like that. It was,
yeah,
it was pretty weak in my eyes. And you know, at that point in time, I had the reflection. I was like, do I want to maybe juice this a little bit and get a little bit more? But I was like, no, our team's down 5-0 with a minute and a half left in the game.
Yeah.
Whatever effort that I would give would not do anything for our team at this point. It would just cause
yeah.
me to miss more games. Right?
Yeah. So. Well, you know, it's interesting you say that. Is the previous game to last night's game, there we had a coach on the other side I was filming above both benches, right? So I can hear you, I can hear this other coach, and this is the Philadelphia team.
Yeah.
Is there any state that is tough for you to play against? Like, specifically a state. We'll just leave it as state. We don't have to say organizations. They're just tough. I can tell you as a fan in the NHL, as a fan,
yeah,
it is really difficult to sit in the stands when Philadelphia's in town. It was really tough because they weren't just yelling at the Vegas Golden Knights fans. They were yelling at each other. Like, it was the craziest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Football team had just won the championship.
Yeah.
So it was like crazy, out of control. But is there, like, do you see yourself with a coach going, okay, this team's, I already know where we're going to go with this one, so we just need to be mindful. Anything?
A little bit. I wouldn't say anything specific to state to state. I've had such a diverse, like, hockey experience where I love authentically passionate people.
Okay.
Too. So, like, it's, if I can look at you and be like, I know what I'm going to get, but at least I think you're authentic and real. I don't mind it.
Okay.
Right? So, it's more on an individual level if it's like, this guy's a poser, this guy's, you know, a blowhard or something like that. But it's, yeah. I wouldn't attribute it to a certain culture. I will also say I've lived in Philly.
Yeah.
And I think Philly gets a bad rap sometimes.
Ooh,
I think
the people
are hard.
Yeah.
And they're tough. But sometimes, like, when you live in that culture, it's not a, I liked it, right? So there's some places, you know, people would say the same thing about Boston, about being direct or rude or anything.
Edmonton was another one that I heard.
Yeah. But I like that. I like the diverse.
Okay.
I like real authentic people that have an identity and a soul, and like you can kind of know what you're going to get from them.
Yeah.
Sometimes too, as opposed to like just vapid nothingness or, you know, I like having some spice or some flavor sometimes.
I mean, yeah, like I said, it's good to a point. So for example, the Philadelphia team that we were playing.
Yeah.
That head coach had said some words that weren't really appropriate for kids 15 and younger.
Right.
Does that get under your skin at all? Hearing I'm sure you would have heard the words that were being said. Does that bother you at all as head coach? Are you just really, I don't care what he has to say? Because when, for example, he had stepped out on the ice, and then now he's spending time talking with refs. Does that bother you at all?
I disagree with that. I will say that I said that to our coaches too. Like, if you're going to tend to an injured player on the ice, tend to the injured player. Don't take that time to speak to the refs.
Yeah.
As a referee, you also hate that too.
Okay.
Where it's like, this is not the environment where we have these discussions.
Yeah. Right?
Because it's just a different look and you can seem animated and... It's just, it's inappropriate for the game at that time.
Got it.
If it's a coach directing inappropriate language at his own team, obviously I don't think it's great for those kids.
Yeah.
But it's not really something that I would intervene with.
It's a great teaching point, maybe even for your own team, right?
Yeah.
Like, listen to this guy.
That's how I would use it, right?
Yeah.
Like, look at how much they're flailing on the bench, right? Like, that, you can use it that way. I think that if it's ever directed at our players too, then that's too much. But that's just not being an adult, right? Like you if you're an adult, you don't yell at kids, right?
Yeah.
You don't say mean things. You have to have that maturity as just an adult, right?
No, you're right. Even from the parents' side, I mean, parents will say stuff. And I was telling Wally in the previous interview, I was like, you know, some of these refs are the same age as the kids on the ice, or maybe a year older or whatever. Mm-hmm. And with, you know, with passionate fans comes passionate conversations with the refs. And I think, as you said, you know, that you put on the stripes, I don't think they care how old you are.
No.
They just care about, did you make a right call? Even though they have no business talking about what is right or wrong. But we sure are opinionated, right? In that sense. Coaching, where do you see yourself in the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of personal transition for me right now where it's tough for me to project my next 2 months, let alone 5 to 10 years. But, you know, I really enjoy coaching. I think that I'm a resource for the kids, and I think understanding how to get the most out of individuals is something that I pride myself on. I'd like to continue to coach at the highest level possible. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it would depend on, you know, my other full-time salary position, how I can work coaching into that. But yeah, whatever I can do to, I really appreciate coaching teams. That's my part. Like, I don't have as much interest in doing just like a skills coaching job or anything like that. But how can you see, you know, marked improvements in gameplay?
Yeah.
Right. Not just like, how can you get a better shot? I think that all of that is very valuable, and there's roles for people like that. But I like taking an understanding of the game at a deeper level of like, now we can make these smaller plays better in the game, and you can actually apply what you're doing from a skill set into a game.
Yeah.
Directly. So 5 to 10 years, I'd like to continue coaching. I don't know how much, how far I can take it, but definitely to the highest level I would like to do it. The other thing with coaching too is like, it requires a lot of sacrifice, right, to move up in the levels. You look at guys like John Cooper in the NHL. Mm-hmm. He didn't play hockey in college, he played lacrosse, worked as a lawyer, coached youth hockey, then coached in the USHL and coached in the American League, and then the NHL. Won at every level, worked his way up, but you know, it's difficult. And then you have guys like Jared Bednar that like spent years in the ECHL, you know, like there's a lot of sacrifices that you have to make from a personal, family, and professional style to get where you'd like to be, especially to be an NHL coach. So I would, you know, have to pay my respects to those that would do it. I don't know right now if I'm willing to take all the steps to move through each level, but I would love to coach to the highest level that I can just based off of where I'm at.
What about scouting?
Yeah.
You said your dad did it?
Yeah, and my grandfather as well.
Any chance to get into that path, you think?
Potentially. I would definitely be interested in it. My dad does amateur scouting, so he goes around and watches, you know, all the draft eligible players for every year. And then their scouting staff projects them as to what NHL player there would be. It's a really fine art of projecting and knowing where they would fit in into the NHL. It's difficult, and it requires a lot of repetition and knowledge of the game and reaching out to coaches and mentors and billet families and stuff. It's a lot that's involved. I give a lot of respect to them. I would definitely be interested in doing it. Mm-hmm. I think that I have some innate knowledge just being working in an NHL organization, being around my family. I think I'll have a lot of, you know, knowledge of how that would go.
Yeah.
But, you know, finding the right opportunity, I would definitely be interested in doing it. Okay. But I got to give a lot of respect to those guys too.
At some point, the hockey career does end.
Yeah.
So if you had an opportunity, like a job outside of hockey, what's your ideal job though?
So I think before I started working for the Vegas Golden Knights, I had, you know, I did my master's in intelligence and international affairs. So I was originally pursuing a lot of careers in the global security, that field.
Wow.
And so I have, and I have an interest in, you know, the intelligence global security field. So that would be something that I would definitely still be open to.
And this is Coach's Masterclass with Harrison Luce, 15 AAA for the Vegas Junior Golden Knights. I appreciate the time.
You've been listening to Vegas Ringside Rundown with your host, Jim and Ron. You can check out their website at www.vegasringside.com. Email them at info@vegasringside.com or check out Vegas Ringside Rundown on X, Instagram, or Facebook.